Hey everyone, I'm Clarissa Lucas.
And I'm Bill Bensing, and this is the Control Freaks. So, today, Sunil Yu. Some of you may know of Sunil if you've read the book Cyber Defense Matrix. Amazing book. I like it. There's a lot of reasons, and some of you, as you know, I am a stickler for terminology and language. So, it was a couple months ago, Sunil and I had a fun conversation, and it was about terminology. So, stay tuned to listen and hear what more we have to say about that. But without further ado, I don't want to take over a spotlight, but Sunil Yu. So Sunil, author of Cyber Defense Matrix, got a lot more to him. But Sunil, welcome. And tell the listeners a bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Bill and Clarissa. I think just being here is, I appreciate the opportunity. So right now, so my past has a lot of different twists and turns, but I wrote the book back when I was the chief scientist at Bank of America, and you may wonder, like, what the heck is that role? Well, in a nutshell, I describe it in a couple of different ways. One was I tried to get fired every day, which was a great kind of job to have. But one of the main responsibilities I had was looking at all the new and emerging vendors that are trying to sell us stuff and trying to make sense of all that to figure out, are we missing something in our portfolio of capabilities? And this is a refrain that many other of my peers have, which is we see all these products and it's just hard to understand what all these different security products do. And when all you see is what there is, it's hard to figure out if there's any gaps. And so my job was to understand where those gaps were, but I didn't have a structure. I didn't have a system to understand how to find those gaps. And so that's where the Cyber Defense Matrix was born out of. I had this desperate need to figure out, how do I organize this in a structured way so that I can see missing things? And the simple structure, for those who are not familiar with it, it's a 5x5 matrix. There's five functions based on the NIST cybersecurity framework: identify, protect, detect, respond, recover. And then five types of things that we care about: devices, applications, networks, data, and users. And so we end up with this bingo card, which helps us, again, organize lots of different things. But anyway, that's it. After Bank of America, I left to actually try to write the book. And I struggled. I spent 6 months trying to write it, and I struggled because I had all these ideas for how it can put it to use. And I had put one of them to use, which was mapping vendors. But all these other use cases I had, I hadn't actually practiced. And so I said, you know what? I need to go and practice them. And so I spent a year seeing if I can find new and emerging vendors, or rather, if I can anticipate what should be new and emerging vendors. And so I spent time with Israeli entrepreneurs, giving them ideas and saying, let's see if this may actually be a real problem. And which was all predicted by the matrix, and it worked out. Anyway, it worked out really well. We'll see whether or not it will work out financially well. That's a different story. But in terms of being able to anticipate problems and validate that this is a real problem in the market, it worked extraordinarily well. So then I said, okay, can I use it for other things? Can I use it to run a whole security program? And so I joined Jupiter One as their CISO to design and run a security program based on the Cyber Defense Matrix. And I think that went well, too. So, but the point is, after having practiced it, writing the book became much easier. And so that's kind of my journey over the past couple of years.
Now, in the book, you have a really cool analogy I want to bring forward. So as we're given the picture of the bingo card, the analogy you give in there was, imagine if you walk into a grocery store with a list of groceries and it's just a big pile of food. That's how you compared a bit of today's cybersecurity landscape is this grocery store, this whatever it may be of food. And I thought that was brilliant. As you were putting this on at Jupiter One and working with the continent here, how did you resolve that paradigm? It was a very interesting image that you painted in the introduction around that. So I wanted to dig a little deeper into that. Like how did you use this to sort of better organize the supermarket?
Sure. Yeah. And by the way, just so it's clear, if you came in with a shopping list and all you saw was a pile of food, you'd have to go through the whole pile before you know if something is missing or not, right? Because There's no other, you know, there's just no system otherwise. So it's really hard. And it's just most of the expo halls that we go to, it is that massive pile of food in the middle of the hall. So even if you know what you're looking for, it's hard to find. Now, extending the food analogy, maybe a bit too far, to answer your question of how I thought about how do we actually operationalize this to create a security program, I also looked at how do you use the matrix to organize not just the ingredients, but also things like the recipes that you want to make, the nutritional needs that we have, the allergies that we may have to deal with, okay? So consider all these different aspects of how we do food. And of course, we have these things in place, but think about recipes as our compliance requirements. So if we have a number of things that we're mandated to do, those are our recipes. Nutritional needs can be thought of as threats. We have nutritional needs around ransomware. We have nutritional needs around phishing. We have nutritional needs around web-based attacks and so on and so on. So what does that mean? And how do we ensure that we have the right set of controls and ingredients for that? And then lastly, on the allergy piece, we all know that different people have different dietary restrictions. And so we can't necessarily impose security controls on everyone and not suffer some sort of business impact. So we have to understand we have constraints and limitations. And so even though I may want to lock up a computer and put in a brick of concrete and throw it into the ocean, we know that's not going to be a useful construct for most businesses. It may be pretty secure, but that's not really helpful for the business. So understanding these allergies and organizing allergies, understanding the nutritional needs and organizing into the matrix, all these things I've been able to actually put into the matrix and characterize in such a way that I can now process this in a more systematic way. What are the ingredients that we have? What recipes does it satisfy? What are the nutritional needs that it's meeting? What allergies I might need to avoid? And anyway, it's a nice construct that helps us put all these different disparate things into order.
That's a beautiful analogy. And the reason I like this, just thinking through it, it's cybersecurity for a lot of people, like tech in general, is hard. Cybersecurity, even for some of the techie, becomes hard. But relating it back to sort of like working out, nutritions, allergies, I think it's a wonderful model. Actually, just yesterday I was listening to, I think it was something on NPR, TED Radio Hour. There was an individual looking at like how much carbon a whale consumes. Like, and basically looking at it, is it like an investment? A whale could be an asset for carbon. And what he did fundamentally was change the economic equation from like, instead of the cost of a pound of whale flesh, what is the asset value of keeping a whale around based on how much carbon they can pull out? And I use that as a loose analogy to draw back to what you just said, because the question I have here is that for the first time, I didn't really think about looking at like a whale as an asset. And he said basically like over the lifetime of a whale, like $3 million is what it returns as an asset every year. And so when you did this, was there, because I know, and this is where I'm going to bring it back to cybersecurity, nobody really, and I'll say this generically, nobody really cares, and I say that in quotes, until something goes wrong. Then they really care a lot. And so it's almost like it's a cost up until it's not a cost. With your matrix and with your experience, were you able to redefine that economic equation? I mean, because when I think about just working out, health and fitness, like your time invested in working out, that keeps you healthy over the long run. And there's a lot of empirical evidence to show you eat a certain way, you stay active in a certain way, you extend your life and you live a better life longer. So bring this all back around, just thinking the equation, were you able to flip the economic equation such that people stopped looking at cybersecurity as a cost and started looking at it as more as an investment and an asset? Did you see that?
Well, so let me offer. So we talked about terminology being pretty important, and I've thought a lot about. I think a lot about the words that we use, and even the word asset. I've been actually bothered by, because if you think about the term asset in a balance sheet standpoint, it is on a particular side of the ledger. And what's the opposite side of the ledger?
Liabilities.
Yeah. So if we think about cybersecurity, most of what we actually see, or how we typically see the world, is not from an asset-centric view. We actually see it from a liability-centric view. Okay?
Okay.
these resources, these devices, these applications, these networks, these data, these users, if you think about it, if you're honest with ourselves, there are more liabilities than there are that we see as security people. We see them as attack surfaces. We see them as liabilities. Mm-hmm. You don't want an attack surface? Get rid of all these devices, right? Okay. Life would be so much more secure if you had no users, right? So anyway, of course, that's not realistic. So the perspective, nonetheless, is I think our perspective is that it's more liabilities. So what does that mean? It also means that we don't want to carry these liabilities. We don't want to continue to dispose of these liabilities as quickly as possible. And as they accrue, if they're neglected, then they accrue additional hazards and additional concerns. Even in financial terms, there's things like what's called impairment. There's things that limit our ability to address concerns. So our inability to patch something, a liability, in other words, there's an impairment function that we use in finance terminology that really lends itself well. So anyway, my bottom line is that we have this word asset that we use, and maybe we're actually, it's a misnomer. May want to think about this as a liability and less as an asset.
All right, that's interesting. So in the reframing, I see you're going there. So it's, like you said, fundamentally, the first principle is it is a liability because it's an attack service. So by definition, it can't necessarily be an asset. But to your point, reducing the impact of that liability or making that liability less, I don't know what, if something's more liable, but like there's this, it's almost like reducing, like if liability had a number between 0 and 1, take it from 1 down to as close to 0 as possible. Like you may never get rid of the liability, but you can reduce its impact on the balance sheet. Is that another way of stating what you just said?
It is, and one of the discoveries I had with the cyber defense matrix, or the cyber defense matrix, led me to another discovery. It's called the DIE triad, and the DIE triad stands for distributed, immutable, ephemeral. And the perspective is the more distributed, immutable, and ephemeral something is, the less value it has, okay, to the business, and to the attacker. And so what we want is actually assets that have very little impact if they were to be compromised. If an asset is distributed, immutable, and or ephemeral, if it's very short-lived, if it's widely distributed, if it's unchangeable, then it tends to have lower value. So conversely, if it got compromised, if we were to consider the flip side of that, there's lower liability if that asset got compromised. And so to your point, how do I reduce that from whatever number it is to closer to zero? And one way to do that is by having systems become more distributed, immutable, and ephemeral.
Okay, so this is I love having conversations with you. It gets me going. I'm going to be going for like the next 2 days thinking about this.
Lots to unpack. Yeah.
But you die, distributed, ephemeral, immutable. But you talked about words and terminology. And like, I have a lot of professional crushes on people because of the way they think. And when you talked about identify versus detect, like, and just the way you put words to thoughts I've had, I've never been able to verbalize. But tell me, like, your view on terminology and share with our users. Like, and you talk about it in your book, I believe it's chapter 2, the chapter called terminology, uh-huh, and identify versus detect is an example. But could you, like, why is this important? And as you put the defense matrix together and you were working with it, what sort of epiphanies or realizations, or probably in your instance, the evidence to validate your assumptions, did you come through with this real succinct focus on terminology?
Sure. Yeah, so the words identify and detect are, for the most part, synonymous in the English language. But in the NIST cybersecurity framework, they are distinct in terms of their function. And okay, so because the words are synonymous in the English language, we confuse the functions because they have been to have these words that were, again, synonymous. In fact, that problem is particularly exacerbated in the NIST cybersecurity framework document itself, because guess what? NIST, for whatever reason, in defining the word identify, uses the word detect, and in defining the word detect, uses the word identify. Like, please.
To make it more confusing, right?
Make it more confusing, yes. So I had to say, okay, look, there has to be a clear distinction between the functions of identify and detect. Because we confuse it all the time in our language, in our marketing literature, and all these different things. But there is a fundamental difference. And one way to think about the difference is to understand, is this something that happens left of boom or right of boom? Whatever the activity is. So boom, first of all, happens between protect and detect. In the NIST cybersecurity framework, so identify, protect, detect, respond, recover. Between protect and detect is a boom of some undesirable event. And now the question is it happening before or after that? Well, let's consider the word vulnerability. Are we identifying vulnerabilities or do we detect vulnerabilities? Okay. And if you look at the NIST cybersecurity framework again, version 1.1, they define, they say we should be detecting vulnerabilities. Okay, which, again, upon most people looking through it, they would say, well, I mean, sure, we do that all the time, right? Except the word detect, in this case, refers to a right of boom event. When instead, actually, vulnerabilities is something that you try to do before a boom occurs, right? So the appropriate term to use is actually identify, not the word detect. And again, it's a simple construct that says, is this happening left or right of boom? Is it happening before something bad happens or after something bad happens? And if we were to just even abstract out the names, identify, protect, detect, respond, recover, into function A, function B, function C, function D, and function E, is this something that will happen in function A and B or function C, D, and E? Okay. And it's clear it's going to happen before something bad happens, and therefore it's appropriately aligned with the word identify. Anyway, it's these simple constructs that help us really be consistent in our terminology.
That is incredibly helpful. And so I've been an IT auditor for a while and familiar with the NIST cybersecurity framework, but the way that you explained that as to right or left, like that is so simple, and that's kind of my mind needs to simplify things. So that's really helpful. So while we're on the topic of the importance of terminology and two words that are sometimes used synonymously but have distinct meanings, can you talk a little bit about the difference between safety and security? Because those are also things that I think sometimes we use to mean the same thing, but can have very distinct differences.
Yeah, and in fact, in many foreign languages, Spanish, Chinese, Russian, I think, the word for safety and security are the same word. So in many languages, it's the same word, which means that as far as they're concerned, they consider it to be synonymous. In English, we have two words, safety and security. In cybersecurity, we have one word again. So then the question is, what parts of cybersecurity are actually cyber safety and what parts are actually cybersecurity? Okay. And using, again, the analogies are super helpful here. So let's use a food analogy. Well, what is food safety? Food safety is hygiene, compliance, inspections, good practices, personal responsibility, right? And we oftentimes say compliance doesn't equal security. Well, maybe it's because safety doesn't equal security. And yet, again, in many languages, we conflate them to be the same thing. But in security, in the English language, I think there's a distinction there. Let's consider another analogy, aircraft or airplanes. So what is airplane safety all about? Well, if I'm Boeing, if I'm United, my job is to make sure that the plane is maintained, it stays up in the air, doesn't fall to the ground on its own. Is my job as a CISO airspace safety, security? Is my job airspace security or cyber security? Okay, cyberspace security.
Mm-hmm.
Whose job is that actually? It's the government's job to ensure that. So if I'm Boeing or United and I get hit by a Russian missile, it's because the airspace is full of Russian and Chinese missiles. Whose job is it to keep the airspace clear and free of Russian and Chinese missiles? And I would say that's inherently a governmental job.
Mm-hmm.
So this distinction between safety and security, again, it's another two terms that we seem to conflate a lot, but if we consider them as distinct, separate things, it helps us really refine What is our responsibility on the corporate, on the practitioner side, as it relates to safety, versus what are the responsibilities that really are someone else's responsibility, you know, someone else's governmental functions around security?
And so in a more general term, when we're talking about cybersecurity, is that kind of the distinction between safety and security as to what is the organization's responsibility versus what is responsibility external to the organization, or is there a different distinction?
Well, it goes, let's use some of the examples that we've seen in the past with SolarWinds or Equifax. Equifax got hit by a Chinese missile. They tried to, you know, keep their environment clean and well-maintained. Mm-hmm. They were actually actively looking for struts and just missed it. But at the same time, we had an adversary that shot a missile at them and they got hit by it. SolarWinds got hit by a Russian missile. Okay. So the question is that SolarWinds' fault? Is that Equifax's fault? Were they doing their basic due diligence to ensure that their airplane wouldn't fall out of the sky? Now, there is a degree to which I would say what was a Chinese missile 7 years ago, 7, 8 years ago for Equifax is now the equivalent of a bird strike today.
Mm.
If you're a Boeing, if you're United, you definitely have to watch up. You are obligated to be able to deal with a bird strike. And so today we have basic best practices around software bill of materials, software composition analysis, tools that are readily available for you to know exactly where you have software that needs to be patched in your environment. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, then you would say, look, that's a safety issue. And I'm going to audit you for those safety issues. However, with SolarWinds 3 years ago, we had essentially the equivalent of a Russian missile. And right now, it is still not quite a bird strike to say your software supply chain has to be secured in this particular way. We all know it needs to be addressed, but we don't have those tools and practices well understood and honed. So from an audit standpoint, what kind of expectations should we place upon those who for which there isn't a well-established practice yet? Okay. Once it becomes a well-established safety practice, by all means, please audit the heck out of us for those things. But if we're not really sure how to deal with this today, then should we be putting obligations upon the practitioners to deal with what are fundamentally more security issues and not really safety issues?
That's helpful. And as what I'm also learning from this too is that line between what is safety versus security is changing and probably changing more rapidly now than it has in the past too. Tough to keep up with.
It definitely shifts, right? So there are, again, what was a missile strike 7 years ago will gradually become a bird strike. Mm-hmm. What's the pivot point, right?
Right.
And let me also offer, there are, of course, the Lockheed Martins and the General Dynamics of the world. If you're Apple, you need to be able to survive missile strikes. We hope they can survive
right.
missile strikes, right? We all
right.
hope they can do that. If you're a certain class of company where you know you're going to be shot at with missiles on a regular basis, then you better have those necessary defenses. And at Bank of America, we felt we were of similar class to have to deal with those things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you're not well, not everyone has the kind of budget or resources to be able to throw at defending against missile strikes.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting. So hearing you talk about the safety and security and thinking about these differences, ultimately there's always going to be missile strikes no matter what. We have to get there. And this is where you're going on security. Security is all about how do I identify and protect against these missile strikes that I don't know what it's going to be, where it's going to come from, but I can, with some degree of probability, there's going to be something in either the near or future, far future coming my way. Now, as you pointed out, depending upon the company, some of them really got to have their missile defenses down extremely well. Big financial or big other institutional companies, like you talked about Apple, they're a target. So when you know you're a target, you're like, all right, I gotta have some nation state level defenses around my system, broadly speaking, to ensure that. Now let's go the opposite way, where maybe a small, medium-sized business, they're not necessarily being directly targeted with missiles. At the end of the day, they're just not that type of. They're the investment to send a missile the way is just not worth the return on investment, right? But from a safety perspective, there's a lot of other people out there. So this is where sort of the idea of safety comes in. So like, as people have been struck by missiles, and standard practices evolve to identify. And then identify and then detect, whether it's before or post boom, that's where then the safety comes in. So for listeners out there, small, medium sized business listeners, when we start thinking about cybersecurity, now Sunil, quick, slap me on the hand if I say this wrong, but like cyber safety. Is that, I mean, I don't want to like put a buzz term out there because God knows, like this, you know, if our podcast is that popular, it could go wildfire tomorrow, right? Cyber safety versus cybersecurity. But like, if you were to put that word cyber safety versus cybersecurity out there, cyber safety is, have you adopted the practices to ensure that the stuff we know that can happen, whether it's a higher probability of happening to you or not, we know it can happen. That, and this comes like, Clarissa, in your world, it can be audited. Those are things that are deterministic. Whereas cybersecurity is probabilistic. It's a defense mechanism. So show me what you're doing to defend yourself. And then I feel like that's key, because there's a lot of companies, like you talk about SBOMs and software composition analysis, like software supply chain has been around for a while. All of a sudden, post-SolarWinds, people care a lot about it. And to a large degree, it's like, well, just do software composition analysis. And like you said, like Equifax, they're still trying to find their struts. And they were doing everything they could, but they still, somebody else found it before they did. So I think it's, the perspective, as I bring this around into like more of a coherent like thought for the listeners, the real perspective is asking, should your tactics be, if you think about a spectrum of cyber safety on the left and cybersecurity on the right side, and just sort of a mix of the other and a dial that goes from left to right, should somebody be asking themselves, should it be more towards the cyber safety side or more towards the cybersecurity? Is that a good way of tactically thinking about it?
Yeah, so the way I've thought about it in the context of the cyber defense matrix is that the activities that we tend to do left of boom are more cyber safety oriented.
Okay.
And they articulate a set of best practices and expectations around, you know, basic preventative controls. And if you think about, again, food safety, there's a lot of preventative controls that we have for food safety. You can have as much food safety as you want, as many preventative controls as you want. But will that prevent somebody from an active adversary coming in and poisoning your food? Okay. And it won't, right? Now, will it help you know that your food was poisoned versus you had poor safety practices? If you have really good safety practices, you can quickly rule out, okay, it wasn't because of poor safety practices, it was because of a deliberate, malicious, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the goal that we would have to say. If we have really good safety practices, cyber safety practices, then it helps us really quickly isolate that these boom events to be one of true malice from an external adversary versus one where it was just, you know, someone flipped the switch by mistake and, you know, something bad happened. All right. So I think at the end of the day, having good safety practices contributes to isolating cybersecurity issues. But I do see them as being distinct, and it's not a probabilistic thing as much as it's a willful intent, intentional malice being introduced, which, again, it's hard to have preventative controls against malicious actors that are intentional at coming up with clever ways to bypass your controls, right? We should have auditors come in and expect that we have considered the basics around the well understood practices and well understood attack techniques. But and so like ransomware is an example. At this point, ransomware is a bird strike. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the kind of attack that happened to SolarWinds is definitely not a bird strike. And so having auditors come in and hold us to account for those type of things that are at this point missile strikes is just unfair. But having us held to account for those that which are bird strikes is absolutely fair game. The real question, as Clarissa mentioned, is at what point does it become a bird strike? And, you know, I think the standards of practice, we have to figure that out and ensure that we are holding people to account, but not too early and certainly not too late.
And so I think that's a really good transition into one of the other things that we wanted to talk to you about is kind of the cyber defense matrix. And we just talked about safety versus security and how that kind of fits into or plays with organizations leveraging the three lines model. And just a real quick for our listeners who aren't as familiar with the three lines model, it's a visual representation of three different lines within an organization. It used to be called the three lines of defense model, but the Institute of Internal Auditors revised that, gosh, it's probably been 2 years ago, maybe. I think it was in 2021, to just talk about just the three lines. So first line being management that's ultimately accountable for the risk. Those are the groups that are typically performing controls. Second line being more of a risk management, risk assurance type function, compliance, QC, QA, those types of roles that are more setting the expectations for risk management and then providing typically some level of assurance over those controls. And then you have your third line, which is internal audit, which is that independent lens providing assurance to typically the board of directors or the audit committee. So sorry to went down that rabbit hole, but the question is more how do these concepts play with or relate to the three lines?
Yeah, so at Bank of America, we of course had that three lines of defense as well. I'm not sure if I can represent all three lines extraordinarily well in the cyber defense matrix, but there is another part of the cyber defense matrix that I haven't talked about, but is actually a really fascinating part of the matrix. So at the bottom of the matrix, I show this degree of dependency between people, process, and technology. Now, I've actually changed the word process, where I've modified the word process to put process slash govern.
Okay.
And for those who are familiar with the upcoming release of the NIST cybersecurity framework, they're adding a function called govern. And I actually disagree with having another column for govern. I think governance, as much as process, is something that transcends all functions.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that we're really asking is, how do we know that these processes, these activities that we're doing, these functions that we're performing, are the right set of functions, and that they're actually accomplishing the goals that we have in mind? And so at some level, whether it's the second line or third line function, I see a lot of that represented in that process slash govern part of the matrix. I haven't really distinguished which ones would be second line versus first line, but sorry, second line versus third line. But the first line, of course, is like what's in each of the actual boxes. And then the second line comes in and lives above all that to say, okay, are we actually doing what we're supposed to be doing? And then again, the audit function that can come in and nitpick at those things. Anyway. Anyway, so but the perspectives of how we that is divided up is not entirely clear. I haven't been able to articulate that very clearly in the matrix, but at least in the context of having the process govern function or activity that transcends all those activities is something that I've put in as a part of the model itself.
And so, when you were talking about use cases earlier, between that and what you just said here, I had some thoughts, so maybe this helps answer some of the question from an audit perspective or a third line perspective. Potential use case that I see with this is from a third line or even a second line is using it as an assurance map. So I love what you said earlier. You said when all you see is what is there, it's hard to see if there's any gaps or see if there's anything missing, which is. Like, I'm going to put that as a post-it note on my monitor here to remind myself of that, because, you know, a lot of times when we go into spaces as an auditor, we'll look at what controls do you have in place, and then we'll test the effectiveness of those controls.
Mm-hmm.
But if we go with that control first mindset rather than a risk first mindset, we could be missing an opportunity to identify controls that don't exist, where there are risks. So we just have, here's these list of controls. We're going to tell you whether those are effective, which is incredibly valuable. But there's also the value of, here's this risk. What control do you have in place to manage that risk? And if the answer is we don't, that's an opportunity to provide that value there. But to your point, if all you see is what's there, you're missing that opportunity to identify gaps there. So Sorry, circling back to that because I thought that was really cool, and I think that's something that the cyber defense matrix can help with from an audit perspective too, of here are the expectations or here are risks that the organization might face, and then not just from a NIST cybersecurity framework perspective, but broken down by the different assets or liabilities or pieces of technology or areas along the y-axis there. And then using that as an assurance map to see where do we get coverage from an audit perspective to identify whether there's coverage of those risks by the first and second lines.
So there's a so in behavioral economics, there's a cognitive bias called narrow framing. And narrow framing is really that what you see is all there is sort of view of the world. And we have it again, it's a cognitive bias, so we naturally do this on a regular basis. The cyber defense matrix was intended to provide a broad framing way of looking at the whole world to say, here's all the things that here's the range of options and range of considerations. Now, we may choose. So actually, so there's 25 boxes in the cyber defense matrix. Think of it like a football team. I can only pick 11 boxes. I can't afford another player. In fact, it's a penalty if I put a 12th player in, if I try to check 12 boxes. So the question is, which 11 boxes are you going to cover at the expense of 14 other ones? Okay. So in other words, we know we're limited in our resources, and we need to be very deliberate. May I call it a risk managed approach, right? To say we're taking risks here because we think that there's a greater risk there. Now, you come in as an auditor and all you see is the 11 controls, and you're like, okay, well, surely that's all there is, right? And of course, the answer is no, there's a lot more things that we have to worry about. But I think it's a really useful question to come in and say, well, give us a reason why these controls weren't included. And there's a perfectly rational reason. There may be a perfectly rational reason for that. What you don't want is for them to say, oh, I hadn't considered that at all, right? Because now you're like, okay, well then that may completely refactor your prioritization for all these other controls. What the cyber defense matrix helps us to do is to say, look, here's the full space, and I may deliberately choose not to put controls in certain places because of these reasons, but we at least acknowledge that there exists a potential need for controls here, which we'll risk monitor until time that the appropriate time comes around. But at least we know that we're not missing something, okay? And that's I think that's this broad framing view of the matrix is one of the things that I have found to be really useful. It gives us the full scope or space of what to consider, and that way, what you see is not all you get. It's you have the broader, the complete framework gives you that holistic view.
And when I hear that, I think of articulation of risk tolerance. So it seems like a helpful way to have that conversation about risk tolerance and risk appetite. We're intentionally choosing not to spend the resources on these risks because we have decided that we can tolerate that risk here, but we're not willing to tolerate the risk in these areas. So I think that's another important use case scenario for the matrix.
Yeah, and people scored on the defense in football all the time, and the coaches asked, why did you do it that way? Well, at the time, this is the best we knew, right? And we made a risk management decision at the time. Why did you get compromised? Well, here's what we knew at the time. We believe this, and maybe we're wrong, but it at least provides a defensible reason as to why you're making the decisions, the trade-offs that you're making.
You hit something there, the defensible reasons, and like listening to you talk about risk tolerance versus it's like I'm just the words like I'm enthralled in this conversation because what you just said there is I find it very critical because like in a world where everybody wants to have zero defect, which never happens, in a world where Six Sigma is truly way too expensive, like at the end of the day, is it two or three Sigma? What you're talking about here is I think is very key for everybody to listen to because it's not like am I completely buttoned up? because that's not the right answer. Am I completely buttoned up? Like you pointed out, like we have this 20, like with the matrix, you have these 28 boxes. The question is, have you thought about all the 28 boxes? And have you said, here's what I'm investing because I have a limited set of resources. And I love how you bring behavioral economics into this. Like, have I thought about these resources? Have I addressed my biases to ensure that these are the proper trade-off for what we're trying to do? And then outside of the controls for the 11, the explanation for the subsequent, what is that, 20 or 14, the other ones?
14.
There you go. I can't math.
We've already established we don't math on this on this podcast, so.
but I think that's critical because, like, I look at what's happening right now with the SEC and Tim Brown and the folks, like, and it's like some of the stuff you're saying is very interesting. Like, maybe their lawyers get a hold of this and it helps them with some of their argument. But, like, at the end of the day, I'm like, you know, CISOs are going to be put on a spear. And every time, like, now it's a very politically expedient way to diverge from other things that are happening. Like, oh, look at that CISO. They got hacked. And it's like, hold on a second. Here is our here's our chart. There's actually a chart called Wigmore's chart. Wigmore's chart actually charts it was developed in the early 1900s. A professor by the name of Gene Goodwin actually re-brought it up in like the mid-80s, 90s, wrote about it. But it charts a legal argument and the strength and the weaknesses of a legal argument. And so, like, it's funny because as I look at some of the stuff from the governance engineering background, what I'm really trying to do is, like, how do you chart a legal argument at the end of the day that you're doing what you've done? And I love what you've talked about, what you both have just brought up, because it's like my mind's blown on this one, like how it can combine some of the stuff, because nobody's saying you hear zero risk tolerance and all this other type of stuff. It's like, listen up, there's a probability something bad's going to happen. You have to accept it and you have to, like, know it's going to happen. But, like, let's be very clear about where we're going to draw the lines and where we expect it to happen. And then let's be very clear with our controls and very specific and deterministic on where we don't want it to happen. And then that's our strategy. And guess what? Like you pointed out, like every once in a while, a goal gets fast past the defense. Why? There's always a probability of something happening. Now, what did we learn from that? Do we have to generate a new, do we have to bring something from the security into the safety realm? Like, then you have the questions, the post hoc questions there. With that being said, I think we're getting at time. Wow, this flew by quick. Let's leave you with the last word. So for our listeners, as we've gone through this, what is probably knowing that it's the tech geeks and it's the audit geeks, and we're trying to bridge that gap. What's some advice that you can give folks on both sides to help, especially with things like the cyber defense matrix and other thoughts you have on how to better broach this? And I just to call it cyber safety versus cybersecurity.
Well, you hit upon it earlier. I mean, we're all trying to work towards a common goal. And even though it may seem adversarial at times, you know, we're trying to make things better. And unfortunately, this manifests in many different realms, whether politics or in the social dynamics or whatever. But we talk past each other in terms of language. And being able to speak on the same level is actually, I think, really important. So having common language, common understanding, common definitions is useful. To that end, let me leave one little bit of advice for those who are wanting to use the cyber defense matrix. So just as if I pulled up Google Maps and I said, hey, I mean, Google Maps is really useful, right? Can you tell me how to get to the bathroom in your building using Google Maps? And of course you can't. Right, no. It's the wrong model for that specific task. As useful as it is, it's the wrong model. So the cyber defense matrix is useful. I think it's useful, and I've found tons of different use cases for it. And there's a lot more that I've dreamed up. But that said, it's not useful for all use cases. It's something that I think has been really useful at this very strategic 50,000 foot level, but it has failed in its utility at a 1,000 foot level. And it's just something to be mindful of. And this is something that, again, going back to language, for a while, I used to be really irritated when people would use the word risk wrong. Okay. They would use the word risk, and I would say, that's not the word. That's not, you're using the word risk wrong because that's not what I understand to be risk. Well, it turns out, if you're traveling at the 50,000 foot level, directions are given as northeast, southwest. At the 1,000 foot level, directions are given as left, right, straight. Okay. Mm-hmm. Directions, like risk, uses different language at different altitudes. And I have to just recognize that, and we have to recognize that and say, let's make sure that we understand what language we're using at the right altitude. Even though we may be using the exact same word like risk, let's make sure that we understand what altitude we're operating at and then how to use that terminology properly.
And I think that would solve way more problems beyond just what we talked about today, but I see that as a common root cause of a lot of different conflicts in organizations.
Absolutely.
So Neil, thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it. I know I've learned a lot, and I'm excited for our listeners to listen as well.